And in the second half of the show, we speak with Anya Ochtenberg about her new novel, Blue Earth. She teaches writer's workshops around the country, including at The Loft and the University of Minnesota's Split Rock Arts Program. She has also written the novella, The Stories of Devil Girl, and the poetry collections, The Stone of Language and I Know What the Small Girl Knew.
When the wind picked up the child to dance her through the green air, her end of the school year dress caught on a splinter of the door. A jagged mouth was ripped in the fabric as the other children were guided to the basement, but Carver had been sitting steady across the road, watching her among the others, though the Twister was but a parking lot away. He ran to her as he had dreamt, to carry her to safety, her soft arms around his neck, she like his own sweet girl. It was more than luck that he was there. It was more than luck that he had dreamt all night of the winds carrying off the farm the bankers had stolen from under his feet. It was more than wind that carried her to the safety of his room beyond the motel sign that now swung sideways on a dead cord. Carver set her down and wiped her tears away with his handkerchief. She ran to the window where the rain had spilled through and pressed against the glass to find the school across the way. "It's okay, Angie. I know your mom and your pop." "You do?" "Sure, they come to my gas station all the time. They show me pictures of you, and I show them pictures of my little girl, and that's how come I know you're Angie." "Oh," she whispered, and the roof shook, and there was no light in the room as the worst of it came to pass over the motel. "I have something for you that's very nice," Carver said, in a lull in the battering of hail. The girl looked up, and Carver saw the northern sky in her eyes and was dazzled again. He pulled out the cedar chest where the new dress floated on top of layers of old things. He held it up in the dim light and prayed she would see its beauty. Lace, those puffy sleeves, a blossom at the belt, and more roses, fine ones. Rosettes, the store lady would say, at the collar. He turned to her, soft in his love, even as the hailstones struck the tinny roof, ugly but strong, that lay under the raving sky. "Come put it on." He had to speak up so she could hear him. "Please," he remembered to say, hearing his wife's annoyed cough at his abrupt ways. And what would he do with the dress now anyway? Kate sent back each package he had mailed to Rosie. Angie came closer, but when the sign swung at the room and sent the pebbles of plexiglass and the shards of window glass in a cascade through the frame that had given him a view of the school, she screamed and flung herself under the bed, scooting to the middle of the darkness and rolling up. Didn't she know he would never let anything hurt her? They stayed this way for a while, their breathing tight in the sudden quiet, until the siren went off again. By mistake, he was sure, since he could feel the storm breaking. "Come, Angie, put on the dress. Think how happy your mom would be to see you in such a pretty thing," he said. "Think how proud your pop would be." She stuck her head out from under the bed and saw the full peach dress swaying in front of her. Then she saw the slit of light entering from under the door and ran to it and wept again, combing the light with her small fingers. She lay there and heaved out sobs for some minutes, and he waited, remembering that he had been told he was not patient when the planting was going or the crops were being taken. A great sneeze came from the child on the floor, and with his worry that she would catch cold or worse, he said, "Think, Angie, think about your dress all torn up. Think how they'll feel to see what the storm's done to you." She looked up at him, and then he knew. He could lift her into his arms, slide off what was torn and drenched, rub the one clean towel over her till her skin warmed and the room warmed, and lower the new dress over her fragrant head, her sleek arms come through each bowl of sleeve. He zipped the long zipper tooth by tooth up to the back of her neck, careful not to catch a thread of gold from her head. "Oh, Angel," he said in his softest voice, as her neck lifted up from the collar of rosettes, and all he could think was swan, white swan in the garden. Spin around, spin around, twirl your skirt, he said, and she smiled a bit in the dry clothes and turned like a ballerina as she did in the backyard under her father's eyes. He didn't know what to do next when she stood still in front of him to make her feel safe. Now come sit here on my lap and rest with me till the rain stops, Carver said, patting his thighs. And she did, both quiet then, as the storm settled back down into the earth.
And that was Anya Ochtenberg reading an early section from her new novel, Blue Earth. Anya Ochtenberg's publications include an autobiographical novella, The Stories of Devil Girl, and two books of poetry, The Stone of Language and I Know What the Small Girl Knew. Her short fiction has received awards from Coppola's Zoetrope All Story, New Letters, and the Raymond Carver Short Story Contest, and others. Her poetry, as well, has won numerous awards. Anya teaches creative writing workshops, especially in fiction and memoir, and a series on writing for social change, Redream a Just World. And Blue Earth has been previously excerpted in Harvard Review, and I think that was a section that was excerpted, right?
That was, yes.
Yeah. Well, welcome to Write on Radio.
Thank you so much.
That's it. You should move a little closer to the mic.
Okay.
There we go.
Okay. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Mike. So, yeah, that's a pretty exciting section that you just read there, and without giving too much away, can you just tell our listeners a little bit who those characters are and how that fits into the rest of the book?
Yeah. Carver... in one of his soft moments, that's Carver. Carver had a farm near Mankato and lost it to auction. His wife took his daughter with her. And he moved to Minneapolis. He works in a gas station. He's a pretty pissed off guy in general. And he sort of gets fascinated with this little girl who is a perfect, beautiful little child. She kind of looks like, I bet you look like me. But, I must have been thinking about you. But, and he sort of gets obsessed with her for many reasons.
Uh-huh.
He has a relationship with her parents. Her father is... someone who they came off the farms long time back. He has some Dakota in his family. The little girl's mother is Barb, who is ill through much of it. Who's done farm work, left the farms, worked at Honeywell back then, making cluster bombs, not quite knowing what was happening. And so Carver's presence is very important, actually, through the book. There are other very important characters, but he kind of took over.
He's sort of the central character that links a lot of them together, but by no means the only character that's wrestling with difficult stuff. Though with Carver, I have to say, I mean, he's I don't know if despicable is the right word for him, but he really is a mean man. And what was it like to have to live with that character as you're writing this book?
sort of like living at home. No, I didn't mean that. Well, the funny thing was, this started as a short story about beauty and ugliness.
Mm-hmm.
And there was that sort of judging voice, and in a sense, Carver
is a judging voice. That's what we should explain. Yeah. That's one of the, that's really at the heart of all of his despicable stuff.
Mm-hmm. And why people become like that is very interesting. And
yeah.
And that, so he kind of took over, and part of how that happened was just sort of all the relationships between who judges and what's judged, who's excluded and why, who's to have power over whom. And I would just keep hearing, as a complete non-practicing whatever I am, thou shalt have dominion. And that seems to me one of the one of the thorniest instructions that whatever that was ever given. And,
yeah.
And so it's that playing out in many, many ways of what it means for some to have dominion over others.
Right, right. Yeah. And I, And Carver is not the only person who's wrestling with these things in his background, and I love that you are able to finally show where that comes from and show a gentle side to him as well. So I'll just mention that in case somebody's reading the novel and says, I don't want to stay with this man any longer, you know. because there are some characters in the novel that appreciate him, but they have their own troubled backstory as well.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that? I'm thinking of Mary, for example, character of Mary.
Yeah. Mary is for a while Carver's girlfriend, and for very good reasons, they're not together, and things happen, and things happen later. But Mary is someone who also grew up on a farm, and her father was from Indiana, which is known for many good things, but also was the place that the Ku Klux Klan first came about. And her father was brutal. And part of her father's is very interesting to me, because her father was, there were events around a young African-American who, when she was a teenager, they got very friendly, and sort of the response of her father is something that one can see in characters like Carver, where there's just a phenomenally tense, angry, combative relationships between these certain folks and everyone else, everyone mm-hmm. that does not seem to fulfill an ideal as to who inhabits and who has dominion over the land, over this place.
I have to say, as I was reading this novel, I started thinking about how my own perceptions of myself developed. And I was so thankful that, as far as I can tell, consciously at least, that my family didn't instill those ideas of domination in me. I mean, I didn't feel like I was being dominated. I didn't, you know, and I think that's actually perhaps why I have sought out certain kinds of people in my life and avoided others, mm-hmm. because that domination thing just felt so wrong and alien that I sometimes I don't even recognize it, but it's mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's like, oh, why would somebody behave like that? That's so strange.
Yeah.
So I have to recommend this book to people who are interested in exploring these issues in their own lives, because it really makes you think about where you come from, where your own thinking evolves from. And it is also about what I've heard variously described as inherited grief or cultural trauma and that sort of thing, and not just within single families, but also mm-hmm. in whole cultures, because, of course, a lot of the characters are feeling this not just from their families of origin, but also the cultures they're living in. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that I think is very significant, actually, I was reading something by a man named Michael Taussig, who I actually studied with when I did go to school, and he was talking about the secrecy, about when certain crimes against people are enacted, and the need for secrecy and the need for keeping people separate. And so that people live with their own nightmares, in a sense. And I think there's a lot of this on the familial level, but part of what this also is about is the terrain of Minnesota. And it's that Minnesota came from Native peoples, was taken from Native peoples, and all of the horrors and all of the sort of genocidal actions against Native people, and the response, and that the whole, I mean, this is the 150th anniversary of the Dakota conflict, and people have asked if I planned it this way, and if you knew when I started this book, it was not in this century. So the plan was not in any way to coincide or to try to, you know, push into something that is a very important, very solemn, very significant discussion and year. But this is something that had been with me very long, because part of the question of historical trauma, of that shared trauma is you know, the way that it's present in Minnesota, obviously nationally, but how that sort of works out between groups and within groups and within oneself. Mm-hmm. So there are Native characters in here, and I certainly didn't feel completely adequate to writing them, but I was visited in a sense by them and found that the connections were incredibly important, and the presence was incredibly important to the story. And so, and Carver's kind of response to that will show, I think, more of that conflict.
He goes through a couple of significant turning points. I'll just say that. How is that? You have another section that you want to read. Okay. Why don't you read that? Yeah. About Barb, a character
it's
we haven't mentioned
Barb.
At all.
Barb, yeah.
She's going through another kind of trauma.
Oh, poor Barb. And Barb is Angie's mother. And
the little girl's mother.
Yeah. And Barb has never been beautiful, according to standards, and but she's also very ill. She's the woman who worked on the farms and worked at Honeywell, and she has cancer. So here's Barb. Barb could feel it, the flesh house falling away, the prison of it. This was the fulfillment of all those days, those nights, when she told herself it didn't matter, that the body wasn't her true home, just a temporary address. Ugliness, the signpost of a moment. Being in this life, that was the dream, but such a real dream. And she inhaled the smell of baby powder and her own daughter with breasts full of milk like a grown woman. Such a beautiful dream, her husband climbing into bed when he could sit up and watch her no longer. August, stroking her cheek, her arms, and she, Barb, falling asleep in his embrace. Such a real dream, to be in this body and learn what it needed to teach her. She sat up. She pushed down the blanket and pulled up an inch at a time, her big nightgown with its dance of roses spiraling toward her. It was caught beneath her, but she had to see, she had to know what was falling away, what she had dreamt all these years. The cloth scraped her flesh. But then she could see the house of the body she'd been dreaming, and she wondered who had dreamt it first, what god had lain drunk, and in the tremors of the night formed her a great drunken world full of caves and crevices in the hills and long curves scored by glaciers by the sharp weight of ice. The covers cast away, there she was, all dream. Flesh dimpled and scarred, her belly still round, her breast still dreaming, the nipples drooping to each side of her chest. Cockeyed breast, she laughed and then grabbed at the covers in case someone would hear her, walk in and see her there in her awful house, her ramshackle costume. She laughed again, still alive there in her laugh. Dead weight. Is that what they would say when they tried to move her? She'd read chapters of Gulliver's Travels with Angie. She could see the tiny men swarming over her with ropes and pulleys to try to lift her. But then she saw how her legs had grown thin and her arms, even her fingers, had not the same thickness, the same journey around, and she knew it was true. The awful house was falling away. The wind entered through the screens and stirred the air around her. She remembered the dress that swirled up like white petals to show off the long, firm stems of legs that stayed planted even in the wind, the view of the body obscured by the painted fingernails that tacked down the skirt at the place of desire. She knew the famous woman, the blonde Marilyn, had been caught by the camera standing over an open grate, and that her legs were parted wide to give her balance on her high-heeled shoes over the darkness below her. She wondered at what was hidden of the famous body, and then at the whole back of her own body, lost forever to her scrutiny. She squinted and remembered her behind, how it moved under dresses in waves, dismissed. Desired, too, she recalled. Men whispered at her, and she still heard the things they'd said and burned with embarrassment. She recalled the day she decided that nothing she couldn't see could hurt her and gave up staring at herself in the mirror and weeping there, begging God for beauty. She saw all the pretty faces turn to look at her, the fat girl, focus on her with eyes thick-lashed and heavy-lidded, pure blue, deep brown, ocean green, filled with the old scorn. She'd walked out of one house, out of one town. She would walk out of this one, too, and be free of what flashed at her from magazine pages and television screens, from the thick-voiced movies that appeared from behind old velvet curtains. Free from the ever-present gaggle of teenaged girls at the mall, their tumble of perfect limb and precise pour of breast, their hair that fell like magic over the forgotten skull and its electrical sponge that was not beautiful, that was not the color of cloud or flower or rare dark wood, of berry or spice or intoxication, but a gray sponge sparked to frenzy by the deep charge and wild turnings of the feeling mind that knew nothing of the embroidery of hair that sat above it and veiled its true ardor. She'd walk out of the belly sag and the crushed breasts and the pitted garment, the ragged crown and the shriveled lips. She'd leap out of her own eye sockets. She'd storm the barricades of flesh. And she remembered that, the workers in 19th-century Paris, the poor with their wooden shoes and their weary, soot-encrusted faces, hungry for better, storming the barricades and bursting through the prison walls. And she would, she vowed, burst through her body, burst through and pull her heart from it, like a madman rips a phone out of the wall. Only this would not be to disconnect, but to take her heart with her and connect it to the great heart of earth, the great heart of creation. She looked down at her dry, broken feet. She'd never walk out of here, she thought, but she'd fly, fly out of herself. Tell them, she yelled, this is not me. Tell them, she whispered, afraid, to look for me in the beautiful things. I'll be there, she thought, in the lightning strikes, in the sudden reaching down from the sky. She looked at her feet, her legs, her belly, her breasts. I'll be there in the land. Sit with me, she cried out, and August ran in and held her and put his hands everywhere she hated and would leave, and then she wanted to stay, always, in this house that she loved like no other.
Mm. Anya Ochtenberg reading from Blue Earth. That's an amazing section. One thing I think it's important to emphasize for our listeners, you talked, Barb is known as the character who's ugly, you know. I mean, that's how everybody sees her, except her own husband and daughter.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little bit.
Oh, I love Barb so much.
Yeah.
And Mopsik's no beauty either, as they say.
Yeah,
yeah, her husband.
His name is August here, but yeah, we know him mostly as Mopsik.
He's
yeah.
a skinny guy.
Yeah.
Part of what happened is that they are a couple that come out of deep toil, out of very, 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 very hard work, out of constant labor, out of losing and loss and being moved and all of that. And I think what happened was that birth of that little Angie girl, who is absolutely a beautiful, perfect little child and also very sweet, actually. But that sort of that possibility that came from them. But the sort of the way Barb is very capable of love, but pretty much hates herself, hates that whole thing, except in that exactly the way that that family, that beloved family, made her beautiful. But she becomes then one of the sort of areas in a sense of combat, because Carver has his very specific ideas about beauty and its importance.
And he's a friend of her husband's.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, we only have like a minute or two left. You're reading tomorrow night
at
Subtext Books at 7 o'clock.
7 o'clock.
And let's see, we should give the address for that. Do you have the address handy? It's over...
It's Selby and Western?
It's Garrison Keillor's old bookstore space.
It's 165 Western Avenue North.
Right. Right below the coffee shop over there.
Yes,
Nina's. Yeah, Nina's, yeah. So you're going to be reading, and I understand you're going to be talking about the book a little bit, too.
Me talking? Yes. I believe only if people want me to. Otherwise, I will dance salsa.
That was
the plan.
And maybe you could... Between the two genres, the talk and the fiction reading, you can do your salsa thing.
I can have a moment, and I do understand there are places nearby that have cheesecake. So there might be...
inviting people to join you for a cheesecake after...
Okay. Event. I mean, not on me, so to speak. it's judged
in your having dessert in your presence,
But,
that would be a lovely thing.
It absolutely would.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it all.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show, and it's a really fascinating book, and... yeah, I wish I could say more about it, but we'll just have to leave it at that, and listeners will have to read for themselves.
Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for being on the show, and now this.
New to town? New to the one-of-a-kind audio experience that is KFAI?
Want to be part of that experience? Why not become a volunteer?
KFAI is always open to creative people looking to share their energy.
If you're interested in news reporting, engineering, helping in the music library, or at KFAI-sponsored events, contact me, Pam, at PHILL@KFAI.org. That's PHILL@KFAI.org. Thanks.
Thank you.
From your friends at KFAI.
You've been listening to Right On Radio. I'm Lynette Rainey Grandel.
And I'm Steve McElstrom. I'd like to thank our guests tonight, Steve Kemper and Anya Achtenberg. Don't forget to tune in next week when our guests will be Pendrid Noyce, who will be talking about her new children's book, The Ice Castle, and Lorna Landvik, who has a new book out as well. And if you don't already like us on Facebook, you can do that anytime. We'd be happy to have you.
I like you on Facebook,
Steve. Oh, thank you.
I like you off Facebook, too.
Well, that's rarer, of course, but appreciated nonetheless.
You are listening to KFAI Fresh Air Community Radio, 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and 106.7 FM in St. Paul, and on the web at www.kfai.org. And now stay tuned for Bonjour, Minnesota.